Fish sauce. Fish sauce is the mother of all condiments, most prevalent today in Southeast Asian cuisines. 2,000 years ago, it was the favorite condiment of classical Rome. Then and now, fish sauce is a strategy used in coastal areas to turn abundant small marine life into a nutritious, stable, and flavorful food resource. Fish sauce is essentially liquefied fish. The cells of the fish are transformed from solid to liquid state by enzymatic digestive processes described in the scientific literature as autolysis, self-digestion, and hydrolysis, digestion into water. Reflecting on the fact that this process spontaneously begins in salted fish if not quickly dried, historian H.T. Huang writes that fish sauce was an invention that was just waiting to happen. Use fresh, whole, small saltwater fish, mollusks, or crustaceans with their viscera, organs. The enzyme or enzymes responsible for fish protein hydrolysis are chiefly located in the visceral organs, reports Keith Steincross. According to a team of researchers investigating the production of Thai Nam Pla fish sauce in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry, fish are left at ambient temperatures for 24 to 48 hours prior to salting. This actually initiates the fermentation process. Next, add salt and stir thoroughly to evenly distribute it. Heavy salting is critical to protect the fish from rapid putrefaction and growth of potentially dangerous bacteria, including C. botulinum. Most contemporary styles of fish sauce incorporate salt at a proportion of no less than 25% by weight. Some use considerably more. Food historian Sally Granger notes that ancient Roman recipes for fish sauce used much less salt, approximately 15%. She attributes the higher salt levels in modern fish sauce to fear of dangerous bacteria such as botulism. However, the International Handbook of Foodborne Pathogens states that 10% salt is enough to prevent the risk of botulism in fish in the aqueous phase, at room temperature. Typically, no water is added to fish sauce. Salted fish are placed in a crock, barrel, tank, or other vessel and weighted down, as in sauerkraut, to expel air pockets and keep solids from floating to the top. Initially, salt pulls water from the fish cells by the process of osmosis. Then, enzyme and microbial processes cause hydrolysis. Depending upon temperature, salt content, and tradition, fish sauces ferment for between 6 and 18 months with periodic stirring. The recipe I followed for a Filipino-style fish sauce called patis, sent to me by my friend Julian, whose mother was from the Philippines, instructed to ferment in a warm place until a desirable aroma has developed. The color also darkens as time passes as more of the fish solids liquefy. I left mine to ferment for about 6 months. It tasted like fish sauce, although I cannot claim to be a connoisseur with a discerning palate. Keith Steincross reports on patis production that the fermentation time ranges from 6 months to a year. In the Filipino tradition, the fish sauce is drained from the solids. The liquid sauce is patis. The residual solids with remaining bones removed are ground into a paste called bagong, also used as a condiment. Fish sauce may be used raw after straining or is often pasteurized before bottling, sometimes with the addition of alcohol. Microbiologists have debated the importance of fermentation in the production of fish sauce. Generally, the number of bacteria steadily decreases in the fish following the addition of salt, writes Steincross. Nonetheless, microbial analysis has established that salt-loving, halophilic, bacteria are likely playing an important role in the maturation and development of typical fish sauce aroma and flavor. This is the basic process. A Roman cuisine enthusiast, Heinrich Wunderlich, suggests speeding fermentation of garum, classical Roman fish sauce, by using a yogurt maker that keeps the fish and salt at 104 degrees Fahrenheit, or 40 degrees Celsius. With whole small fish, or just innards, 15 to 20% salt by weight, and stirring once a day, he writes that the fish liquefies in 3 to 5 days, leaving a bare skeleton. Flavor develops more slowly and is fully developed, even in the yogurt maker, only after a few months have passed. There are many variants on basic fish sauce, some using specific fish, mollusks, or crustaceans, others with added ingredients including sugar, tamarind fruit pulp, pineapple, and grains, either molded, malted in the form of lees, the solid residue from making sake, or even outer husks. There are also hybrid fish soy sauces incorporating soy koji into the fermenting mix. Pickled fish. Fish may also be preserved by brine pickling. In contrast with fish sauces and pastes in which the fish disintegrates, pickled fish retain their form. The most widely known styles of pickled fish, such as pickled herring and its many variations, do not involve significant fermentation. The fish are very heavily salted to remove water and slow bacterial and enzymatic degradation, then later desalted and pickled in spiced vinegar. Although most herring pickling involves limited microbial activity, it involves significant enzyme activity. When the fish are gutted, an enzyme-storing digestive organ called the pyloric cecum is left in place. The enzymes in the pyloric cecum circulate and supplement the activity of both muscle and skin enzymes, breaking down proteins to create a tender, luscious texture and a wonderfully complex flavor, at once fishy, meaty, and cheesy, waxes Harold McGee. With more modest salting, herring and other fish are sometimes intentionally fermented. In late spring and early summer, when their fat content is greatest just before breeding begins, herring are harvested for a shorter and lighter salt, 8-10%, curing, known in Dutch as matjes herring, which involves more, though still limited, fermentation. Historically, these were only available as a seasonal delicacy, but as a result of legal requirements that these herring be frozen to rid them of parasites that can survive the lower salt curing, matjes are now available year-round. Swedish surströmming is a more dramatic example of fermented herring, notorious for its strong odor and flavor. Strömming are the herring of the Baltic Sea. Sur means sour. Surströmming are lightly brined, 3-4% salt, Baltic herring, fermented in barrels for a month or two in the temperatures of mild northern summer. In the contemporary practice, the surströmming is then transferred to a saltier environment and sealed in tin cans to continue ripening. The sign of ripe surströmming is a bulging can. According to Harold McGee, the unusual bacteria responsible for ripening in the can are species of haloanaerobium, which produce hydrogen and carbon dioxide gases, hydrogen sulfide, and butyric, propionic, and acetic acids. In effect, a combination of rotten eggs, rancid Swiss cheese, and vinegar overlaid onto the basic fish flavor. Is your mouth watering yet? I was at a conference at which Swedish food scholar René Valeri, the author of a paper on surströmming, brought some to share. Indeed, the can was bulging from the pressure of active fermentation inside. The tasting was located outdoors because of surströmming's assertive odor. Valeri's paper examined the contradictory characteristics of offensive smell and good taste, and the fact that for any number of foods, not only surströmming, if one is able to overcome the initial reaction and try them, the taste is quite different. As all accounts agree, the smell was horrible and putrid, but intrepid food adventurers, including me, lined up for tastes. As the smelly fermented fish on flatbread entered my mouth, I wondered whether I would be able to swallow it. But as I chewed, I acclimated to the flavor, and the lingering aftertaste left me waiting for the line to be over so I could have another taste. Norwegian rockfisk, also known as rikfisk and rakkoret, is a somewhat similar ferment usually made from trout. Recipes generally specify that the fish must not come into contact with soil for fear of exposure to C. botulinum. The most specific information I have come across is from Wikipedia, where the following process was described. Fish are cleaned and gutted, and their abdominal cavities are filled with salt, about 6% of the weight of the fish. Fish are placed in a crock, barrel, or other vessel, abdominal cavity up, with a pinch of sugar added to each layer. They're weighted, and as salt pulls juices from the cells, the fish become submerged under brine. Fish are fermented in this brine for 2 or 3 months at 40-45 degrees Fahrenheit, or 4-8 degrees Celsius. In the northern climes with suitable temperatures, especially where salt was not abundantly available, such relatively low-salt fish ferments have been a fact of life. A surplus catch needed to be preserved in order to serve as a food supply during the winter months, explains Valeri. The origin of these northern low-salt fish ferments is generally regarded to be the practice of burying fish in the ground. A generic name for these buried fish is grävfisk. In Scandinavia, pits gave way to barrels, and in the case of surströmming, cans. But elsewhere, fish-burying traditions persist, as explored in the following section on burying fish. Interestingly, after a period of waning interest in surströmming, it has become a very popular food throughout Sweden, well beyond the range of its historic use. Similarly, according to Norwegian ethnographer Astrid Riedervold, rakfisk has gone from the tables of mountain and inland farms to chic acceptance in urban society. Valeri wonders why the new adepts have adopted a dish which has such a bad reputation, and offers that maybe one answer lies in today's desire to cross boundaries. Fermented fish can definitely force us to confront and perhaps challenge the slippery and elusive boundary between what is and is not fit to eat. Fermenting fish with grains. One of the limitations of preserving flesh through fermentation is that the fermentation processes that create biopreservatives, acids and alcohol, as byproducts require carbohydrate nutrients, which are in short supply in protein and sometimes fat-rich flesh. In many Asian traditions, fish is fermented with cooked grains, usually rice. The grains provide a carbohydrate substrate for lactic acid fermentation, and the lactic acid in turn creates a selective environment that inhibits putrefaction. In Japan, fish pickled with rice is called narizushi, and is the precursor to the fresh sushi so popular internationally today. H.T. Huang, author of the extraordinary and comprehensive volume Fermentations and Food Science, in the Cambridge University Press's Epic Science and Civilization in China series, documents the practice of fermenting not only fish, but also meat, with grains going back thousands of years. The Chinese word jia incorporates both this tradition and fermented vegetables. Huang translated from the Qi Min Yao Shu, Important Arts for the People's Welfare, written in the year 544, a detailed process for fish jia from carp. The fish is cleaned, sliced, washed, salted, and drained for several hours, or overnight. We call the salt chasing water salt, since it expels water as it is absorbed by the fish, notes the 6th century author, who specifies non-glutinous rice, on the hard side, not too soft. Rice and fish are layered in a jar, then covered by layers of bamboo leaves and stalks. When a light liquid comes up and tastes sour, the product is ready. According to Huang, the same document also describes 6 other types of jia made with fish, as well as meat, both raw and cooked. Filipino Burong Isda and Balao Balao. In the Philippines, fish fermented with rice is called Burong Isda, and shrimp fermented with rice is called Balao Balao, or Buro. The Filipino ferments are relatively quick and quite delicious and offer the added comfort for the squeamish of cooking the fermented fish and rice before eating it. Burong Isda is usually made with freshwater fish. I've made it with milkfish, one of the fish mentioned repeatedly in the literature, and tilapia. Scale, clean, and fillet your fish and cut it into strips. Mix the fish strips with 15-20% salt, about 5-6 tablespoons per pound or 500 grams. Mix thoroughly so all the surfaces of the fish are coated with salt. Let this sit for several hours as salt both pulls water out of the fish and absorbs into it. Meanwhile, cook rice. I'd recommend starting with about twice as much dry rice as fish, by weight, although recipes I've seen vary quite a lot on proportions of rice. Use any rice you like and cook as you normally would. After the rice cools to body temperature, mix it well with the salted fish and its juices, along with chopped garlic and ginger. Some recipes call for adding a small amount, 1-2%, of angkak, red yeast rice, available in many Asian groceries as well as nutritional supplement stores. Pack the rice and fish mixture into a wide-mouth sealable jar, or a crock, pressing downward to force out air pockets. Press down any fish exposed at the surface so that it is covered by rice and leave some space at the top for expansion. If using a jar, seal it. If using a crock, use an interior lid, a plate, or water-filled plastic bag that will cover almost all, if not all, of the surface. Also cover the crock with a fabric secured by a string or rubber band to keep flies out. Ferment 1-2 weeks. To serve, sauté garlic and onion, then add fermented Burong Isda and a little water and cook until well heated, adding more water as necessary. I've really enjoyed Burong Isda several times since I first tried it. It tastes like cheesy fish risotto, and I brought it to 2 potlucks where it was enthusiastically received. Balao Balao is an identical process, only instead of fish it is made with shrimp, with shells but without heads. Shrimp is salted a little more heavily, add about 20% salt, or roughly 6 tablespoons per pound or 500 grams. It is fermented for not quite as long, 4 to 10 days. As fermentation proceeds and the shrimp and rice become acidic, the crunchy chitins of the shrimp shells soften. Like Barong Isda, Balao Balao is cooked after fermentation. The Balao Balao I made developed a very sharp smell as it fermented. It was a July heat wave, so I think it had to do with the temperature rather than some intrinsic quality of the ferment. I also fermented it for nearly 10 days, and perhaps given the temperature 4, or even 2 or 3, would have been plenty. I was not concerned about the safety of the Balao Balao, because the smell that it had is an edge that I have flirted with many times. It did, however, give me the idea to add more ingredients when I cooked the Balao Balao, to dilute that strong smell, and potentially taste, with veggies abundant in my garden at that moment, tomatoes, okra, squash, and beans, into a stew. The flavor of the Balao Balao turned out not to be as strong as the smell, but it was very ripe, in the way that cheeses often are. I loved the Balao Balao stew, though I found the shrimp itself, frozen from Asia, I am sad to report, tough and unappealing. After I made the Balao Balao stew, I stored it in the refrigerator and warmed it up and served it to friends a couple of times. They all seemed to like it. Each time I ate some, I liked it more. As I became more accustomed to the edgy flavor, it became more compelling. When potluck night came, I brought it, recalling how much people seemed to enjoy the Barong Isda a month earlier. Nobody said a word to me about the smell as the stew heated. After I got my food, I went to eat in another room. I heard several rounds of convulsive group laughter in the next room. I intuitively understood that it had to do with the Balao Balao. After acting out his disgust with the smell of it, my friend Jimmy had moved the pot of Balao Balao stew outdoors. Some people ate a little bit in the spirit of challenging themselves. Others passed on tasting it or composted what they tried. It surprised me because I was finding the flavor so compelling. I did notice, after about a week and several reheatings, that the shrimp, so tough earlier, began to literally dematerialize, shells and all, as did the grains of rice. The last of it I brought home and mixed with scrambled eggs and a little flour in a sort of shrimp souffle, which was as delicious to me as the Balao Balao was all along. Online recipes for Barong Isda and Balao Balao vary in many details. Filipino ethnologists R.C. Mabesa and J.S. Baban observe differences in how rice is cooked, dry versus porridge, whether rice is salted, the type of fish, whether it is cleaned, how long it is salted prior to mixing with rice, and use of ang kek. It was noted, however, that there was no major difference in the final product in terms of overall quality in spite of the variations. A 1992 paper by Minerva Olympia of the Philippine Institute of Fish Processing Technology makes the point that these methods were developed in homes and improvements were based on the observations of the practitioners. Fermentation processes are normally handed down from generation to generation. There is little interest in knowing the role of microorganisms and the physical and chemical changes that occur in the products. What is recognized are changes in color, odor, and taste that result from modifications of the process or variations in the ingredients or conditions. A book can only take you so far. Once you try practices such as these, the experiential learning begins. Japanese narizushi. Japanese narizushi, historically made not only from fish but also from mammals and birds, is traditionally a much longer-term ferment. The most famous surviving example of this process is funazushi, a special regional delicacy made from funa, a freshwater fish in the carp family, Carassius auratus grandoculus, unique to a single lake, Lake Biwa, in Japan's Shiga Prefecture. The fish are caught in spring, cleaned and stuffed with salt. They cure just in salt, weighted down to keep them from floating to the top of the vessel for a few months or as long as 2 years. After the salt cure, they are rinsed and mixed with cooked rice, for the fish and rice to ferment together for 6 months to 2 years. Some funazushi makers feel that 2 years are needed for the bones to get tender, over which time the rice too gets so tender that it loses its form and becomes a gluey, sloppy starch of lactic acid, in the words of Japanese-born food writer Kimiko Barber. There are many regional variations of narizushi, some incorporating koji, rice malt, raw vegetables, or sake to speed fermentation. Kabura sushi is made by sandwiching yellowtail between turnip slices and pickling this in rice koji for about 10 days, according to the Tokyo Foundation. Barber describes a number of interesting regional styles. Hokkaido has izushi, which is made with salted giant white radish or carrot and salmon, sailfin sandfish or Pacific ribbed sculpin, while rice malt is added and the whole left to ferment for 3 months. Aomori Prefecture, meanwhile, offers sardine sushi, where the filleted and salted fish is layered with rice, infused with sake, and mixed while it is still warm and left to ferment in a wooden barrel with a wait for some 40 days. Turnip sushi is made in Toyama and Ishikawa Prefecture, where salted salmon or mackerel pieces are inserted in salt-pickled turnips and fermented in seasoned rice for about a week. It has a delicately balanced sweetness from the turnip and a delicious umami-packed taste. Soup congee sushi is made in Yamagata Prefecture as an important part of the New Year celebration dishes, with salmon, herring roe, and spermatozoa of salmon, to which salt-pickled carrot, green beans, and kelp seaweed are mixed with rice and malt. And in some households, sake is added to ferment for between 2 to 6 weeks. These diverse narizushi techniques developed as strategies for preserving fish. The sushi we know, hayazushi, or quick sushi, is an instant version, with rice vinegar replacing the traditional lactic acid fermentation. Naturally fermented sushi came dangerously close to total extinction, writes Barber. Much of the skill and craft has been lost forever. Yet she reports that in recent years there has been something of a narizushi revival. Many small countryside villages have aspired to raise regional awareness and rekindled what were almost lost crafts, reviving fermented sushi in order to boost their village economies. H.T. Huang hypothesizes that simple salted fish, such as fish sauces and pastes, were the earliest fish ferments, followed by the addition of koji-like molded grain to produce jiang from both fish and meat by sometime between the 6th and 10th centuries B.C., followed later, between the 1st and 3rd centuries B.C., by the addition of cooked rice, inspired by techniques in use earlier of fermenting vegetables with rice. Huang translated a method for making meat jiang from the same document cited above, Qi Min Yao Shu, or Important Arts for the People's Welfare, written in the year 544. Beef, lamb, roebuck, venison, and rabbit can all be used. Take good quality meat from a freshly killed animal, trim off the fat, and chop it well. Old meat that has dried out should not be used. If too much fat remains, the meat paste will taste greasy. Mix together approximately 1 tao, i.e. 10 sheng, of chopped meat, 5 sheng of ferment powder, 2½ sheng of white salt, and 1 sheng of yellow mold ferment, sporulated aspergillus mold. These ingredients are mixed together, sealed with mud, in a vessel and fermented in the sun for about 2 weeks. Other historic meat jiang recipes cited by Huang incorporate wine and age for much longer. Fermenting fish and meat in whey, sauerkraut, and kimchi. Even without live lactic acid bacteria, an acidic medium can be used to cure fish or meat. Ceviche is a light and delicious Latin American style of curing fish in lime juice. Over the course of just a few hours, you can see the appearance of fish transform as it is cooked by acidity. I was also once served raw beef by the farmer who raised the cow that was marinated overnight in vinegar and underwent a similar transformation, having the appearance and texture of cooked meat even though it had not been. Whey, sauerkraut, kimchi, and other acidified products with dense populations of lactic acid bacteria can be similarly used as environments to safely ferment meat and fish. In Iceland, fermented whey, sýra, is frequently employed as a fermentation medium for a group of foods collectively known as sýrmatur, meaning soured food, mostly animal and fish parts. Icelandic food writer Nana Rokvaldadóttir recounted to me how whey preserving has been used historically and how she uses it in her own kitchen. Fish was almost always dried rather than soured, although certain parts of it might be preserved in sýra, mostly parts that may not be considered food nowadays, like the stomach, the swim bladder, milt, roe, liver, skin, tail, fins, etc. We are talking about a cuisine of extreme poverty, where everything was utilized. Even the fish bones, along with other bones, were sometimes soured for a year or more, then boiled until they turned into a soft mass which was eaten. I'm told that most bones will go soft if kept in sýra long enough. I haven't tried. Meat was and is soured, but the most common food to be soured is offal. heads and head cheese, trotters, blood pudding, liver sausage, rather similar to haggis, ram's testicles, intestines, udders, and seal flippers, whale blubber, seabirds, etc. Eggs were sometimes boiled, shelled, and preserved in sirah. Small seabird eggs were sometimes soured with the shell on, and then the shell would gradually dissolve over time. I currently have a small plastic tub in my fridge full of sirah with blood pudding, liver sausage, head cheese, and ram's testicles. Rogvalde Dotter reports that sirah can be continually refreshed and used as a perpetual medium. Referring to her mother, she writes, "I don't think she ever changes her sirah, just adds more whey as needed. I think her current batch has been going for 12 years or so." Sally Fallon Morell, a major proponent of fermenting and whey, offers an excellent recipe in her book, Nourishing Traditions, for pickling salmon in whey, where she marinates chunks of salmon for 24 hours at room temperature in diluted whey, one part whey to 8 parts water, with a little added honey, salt, onions, lemon, dill, and other spices. Andreas Hoag of Copenhagen, Denmark, wrote to me that he followed this recipe, but found that it had a very powerful odor that will really challenge the tolerance of the people you share your kitchen with. A modification of the original water, salt, and whey mixture with rather generous amounts of lemons or limes will reduce the odor to a level that is acceptable for most people. Similarly, fish or even meat can be added to kimchi. The Kimchi Cookbook, the most comprehensive reference on the subject that I have found in the English language, contains recipes for kimchis incorporating anchovy paste, oysters, pollock, flounder, kitefish, octopus, squid, crab, and cod. Often, but not always, the recipes call for pre-salting the fish. I've also seen kimchi recipes incorporating both raw salted meat and meat broths. Meat and fish can be similarly incorporated into sauerkraut. In Poland, I ate bigos, meat marinated and stewed in sauerkraut. Historically, the dish is prepared over several days, alternately heating and cooling it, according to Polish ethnologist Anna Kowalska-Lueka. Rick Headley of Sonoma County, California, wrote to me about an old friend of his, a Swedish immigrant to Wyoming, who made vast quantities of sauerkraut in which he often pickled pronghorn antelope loin. Fermentation enthusiast Dallin Credible of Asheville, North Carolina, wrote to report a successful experiment fermenting deer jerky in sauerkraut. I mixed deer jerky that I cut into small pieces throughout the cabbage. It's great. I've also chopped leftover cooked sausages and added them to already mature kraut, and they preserved well, tasted delicious, and enhanced the kraut itself. In a medium like sauerkraut or kimchi that consists of salted raw plant material that will acidify in a predictable way, you can feel free to experiment with additions of small proportions of fish or meat, raw or cooked, without fear. Fish fermentation experiments in Alaska. Eric Haas. My most recent/exciting fish experiment is a halibut kimchi. This one has bits of mango in it. I'm a big fan of the fruit and or nut additions to kimchi. I start with a strong batch of basic kimchi, being sure to use lots of ginger, which helps tenderize meat and breaks it down so that it's tastier and more fully integrated into the mix. Once the kimchi is going strong, about 10 days or so, I add the fish, mixed in as little pieces, seasoned with a bit more of my kimchi paste. I've done it with lightly steamed fish and fresh raw fish, as well as frozen, thawed of course, raw fish. The taste is basically the same. I wait about a week before starting to eat it. I've also been making really nice salmon sauerkraut, using essentially the same method as above. I do a green cabbage/grated carrot/caraway seed/salt kraut, get it going strong, then add in bits of steamed or broiled salmon, mix it up, weigh it down again, and wait a week or so. The salmon becomes really tender and moist and delicious, and unlike the halibut above, retains its flavor and integrity as distinct pieces. Very nice. Fermenting eggs. Eggs may be fermented in a number of ways. Peeled, hard-boiled eggs can simply be buried in a crock of fermenting vegetables, where they are protected by the acidification of the vegetables. Chinese cuisine has its famous century eggs, also known as thousand-year-old eggs, though they are typically preserved for just a few months. Raw eggs are caked in a paste made from baking soda, quick lime, salt, and ash, often with the addition of tea leaves or grain husks, and then left in storage for about 3 months, writes Fuchsia Dunlop, who admits she was revolted by their gray-black color the first time she tried them, but now I adore them. She describes century eggs as something like an exaggerated egg with their rich, creamy yolks. A blogger's report from a Basque confectionery museum included information on a similar technique used there in the late 19th and early 20th centuries to preserve eggs for winter, when egg production slows down. The usual system of preservation of eggs was keeping them in water with lime. The eggs were introduced in large clay pots and covered with a mixture of water and quicklime, which allowed them to keep in perfect condition for many months. H.T. Huang writes about another Chinese style of fermenting eggs. In Zhao, the residue of rice beer making, essentially the same as sake lees, lightly cracked eggs are layered between salt and wine residues and incubated for 5 to 6 months. Finally, William Shurtleff and Akiko Aoyagi describe pickling soft-boiled egg yolks in miso. Cover the bottom of a 6-inch square container with a 1-inch deep layer of red miso. Press the large end of an egg into the miso in 4 places to make 4 depressions. Then cover miso with a layer of cheesecloth and press cloth into depressions. Prepare 4 3-minute eggs. Carefully remove yolks unbroken and place 1 yolk in each of the 4 depressions. Cover with a layer of cheesecloth, gently top with miso, and wait for 1.5 to 2 days. Serve yolks like cheese as an hors d'oeuvre or as a garnish atop hot rice. Shurtleff and Aoyagi also describe pickling hard-boiled eggs in different types of miso. Cod liver oil. Cod liver oil, used as a healing supplement, particularly in some northern European traditions, is traditionally made by fermentation. So are other fish liver oils, including shark and skate. Nebraskan David Wetzel investigated extraction processes for cod liver oil, both traditional ones and those in use in contemporary industrial production. Wetzel learned that the industrial processes used to extract cod liver oil commercially involved alkali refining, bleaching, winterization, and deodorization. Each of these steps, especially the deodorization, removes some of the precious fat-soluble vitamins. As for the traditional method, he cites an 1895 article on cod liver oil and chemistry, in which the author, F. Peckel Mueller, describes the primitive method. In this method, fishermen would bring home the cod livers each day after selling the day's catch and place them in barrels. The fishermen do not trouble to separate the gallbladder from the liver, but simply stow away the proceeds of each day's fishing, and repeat the process every time they return from sea, until a barrel is full, when it is headed up and a fresh one commenced. This is continued up to the end of the season, when the men return home, taking with them the barrels that they have filled. The first of these, it may be noted, date from January, and the last from the beginning of April, and as on their arrival at their homes the fishermen have many things to arrange and settle, they seldom find time to open their liver barrels before the month of May. By this time, the livers are, of course, in an advanced state of putrefaction. The process of disintegration results in the bursting of the walls of the hepatic cells and the escape of a certain proportion of the oil. This rises to the top and is drawn off, provided that not more than 2 or 3 weeks have elapsed from the closing of the barrel to its being opened, and if during that time the weather has not been too mild, the oil is of a light yellow color, and is termed raw medicinal oil. As may be supposed, however, very little oil of this quality is obtained. Indeed, as a rule, there is so little of it that the fishermen do not take the trouble to collect it separately. Nearly all the barrels yield an oil of a more or less deep yellow to brownish color. This is drawn off, and the livers are left to undergo further putrefaction. When a sufficient quantity of oil has again risen to the surface, the skimming is repeated, and this process is continued until the oil becomes a certain shade of brown. Wetzel writes, "After reading this passage and foreseeing the demise of the last natural cod liver oil from Europe, I was determined to produce a light brown fermented cod liver oil according to the old methods." Indeed, he has started fermenting cod liver oil and marketing it under the brand name Green Pasture. Burying fish and meat. Earlier in this section on pickling fish, I introduced the idea that the Scandinavian barrel-cured fish have their roots in a tradition of grevfisk, or buried fish. Along with simple sun, air, or smoke drying, which, if it is effective, does not result in any significant fermentation, burying fish and meat in the ground is among the most ancient means of storing, securing, and preserving a surplus. Originally, this might have been done to hide or protect food from insects and thieves until the hunter could return for it, speculates Sue Shepherd, author of Pickled, Potted, and Canned. According to Shepherd, in England in the Middle Ages, venison was sometimes buried instead of being hung. She explains, retaining its own moisture while lying in the cool, moist ground meant the food would slowly ferment using its own yeasts and enzymes, resulting in a preserved food with a very strong flavor. The practice of burying meat or fish to preserve it has been documented widely, in varied geographic locations, though most prominently in far northern locales. Longer storage is definitely possible in cooler climates. Yet when archaeologists at the University of Cape Town in South Africa sought to recreate the practice of burying whale meat in the sand, as recorded by early Dutch colonizers there, they found that bacterial levels did not increase beyond acceptable levels for raw consumption for about 10 days, and that if cooked, the meat remained edible much longer. But it is in the far northern reaches of the earth that burying fish is widespread and most critical to survival. Culinary historian Charles Perry cites an 18th century account of the Itelmen people of Kamchatka on Russia's Pacific coast. Rot fish in pits until the gristle dissolves. Sometimes it rots to such a degree that it has to be removed from the pits with a sort of ladle. The Scandinavian cured salmon, gravlax, meaning grave salmon, was historically prepared by burying salmon in the sand, although, as described previously, today its preparation involves neither burying nor significant fermentation, but rather a few days of salt and sugar curing, typically under refrigeration. Kiviak is a Greenland delicacy of whole seagulls and auks sewn into the abdominal cavity of a disemboweled seal and buried, seam up so gases can release without rupturing the seal, under a large flat rock to ferment several months. They bite the heads off and squeeze out the tart guts, according to a first-hand internet account. It tastes like a matured cheese and very pungent. There is nothing disgusting in this dish. In Alaska, Inupiat people bury king salmon heads in the ground to prepare a delicacy they call nekarak, known in English as stink heads. A collection of traditional Inupiat ways of preparing and preserving fish, collected by Honora Jones and published by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2006, details how to ferment nekarak, as told by Mamie Beaver of Kotzebue, Alaska, near the Bering Strait. Line a 2-foot-deep hole with green grass somewhere that the sun won't shine on that ground, she instructs. Wash the salmon heads well, get all the blood and scum off, leave the gills in. Put the heads in a flour sack and put the sack in the grass hole. Cover it with a few inches of grass, then cover with sand, and then with a board so people won't step on it. Let it stay until the smell is a little strong and the nose skin slips off or can be easily broken. That skin on the nose is the best part, like soft rubber. Don't let it get too strong. Of course, too strong is a subjective judgment. The same document, filled with oral histories, includes the following exchange about nekarak between two Inupiat elders. I like to eat them when they are green and slimy, says one. I can't eat them that strong, responds the other. When they start to get green and slimy, I have to feed them to the dogs. Indeed, the dogs, too, are part of the overall food system and need to be fed. Buried fish, like most fermentation, exists along a continuum, and sometimes it goes too far. At least for some people, the boundaries are typically not clear-cut. But one boundary that could not be clearer is that fish must never be wrapped in plastic for burying in the ground. Pits are lined with grass or leaves. Fish may be wrapped in burlap sacks. But it is of critical importance to not use plastic in this process, because plastic can create the kind of totally anaerobic condition that encourages the growth of Clostridium botulinum. In North America today, Alaska accounts for a far disproportionate number of reported botulism cases, all associated with improper preparation and storage of traditional Alaska native foods, according to a report of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, CDC. The CDC conducted an illuminating experiment that demonstrated the dangers of fermenting fish in plastic. The Fish and Wildlife Service report on Inupiat fish traditions included this account from a CDC official. We took 4 batches each of the main foods where botulism was found, fish heads, seal flippers, and beaver tail. 2 batches were prepared the proper traditional way, and 2 were prepared as some people have been doing lately, using plastic bags or buckets. 1 of each batch we inoculated with botulism, the other was left natural, was not inoculated. After the fermentation process was complete, we tested them. To our surprise, those batches of foods prepared the traditional way had no trace of the botulism toxin, not even in the foods that were inoculated with botulism spores. On the other hand, both batches, the one inoculated with botulism spores and the one not inoculated, of foods prepared in plastic tested positive for botulism. The advice that came out of that experiment was, keep on fermenting your food, but never use plastic bags or buckets, and be certain that you do it the traditional native way without any shortcuts or changes. Heed that warning, please. In Arctic temperatures, fish need not always even be buried to effectively preserve them. Another traditional fish fermentation method described in this amazing report on Inupiat fish traditions is the simple mounding of fish in piles. The mounding begins in a shady spot as summer wanes. Fish are not fully cleaned, only livers and bile are removed through a small incision, minimizing damage to the fish and the potential for oxidation. Each day's catch is added to the mound and covered with grass. Explains an Inupiat elder. As the weather cooled down, they fermented more slowly, thus the top layer of fish was freshest. On these, it wasn't as important to get the liver out, and we stopped doing that, just as freezing temperatures made it difficult to do with painfully numb fingers. Then we just lay the whole fish on the pile. The liver and bile ferments faster and differently than the rest of the fish and spoils more of an area around it the longer they ferment. After the snow comes and ambient temperatures remain below freezing, the pile is rearranged, separating fish so each can freeze all the way. If this isn't done, they keep on fermenting for weeks until the ground freezes and would become too strong. Once frozen, fermentation stops, and fish, called Tipliaktak Kwak, are removed from the pile and eaten as needed throughout the long winter. To remove a fish from the frozen pile, take an axe and knock one loose. The pile dwindles toward the center, where the fish have more time to ferment. The flesh of the older, earliest caught fish changed to a cheese-like texture with no resemblance to the texture of fish flesh. One analogy of the difference between fresh and Tipliaktak Kwak is the difference between drinking fresh water and drinking a rich, salty soup or a strong, sweet wine. There just are so many more flavors, rich, complex, always differing flavors, in the Tipliaktak Kwak. Yet stronger is not always better. As we eat these fish, we are continually judging what fish or part of a fish we want to eat and which parts are too strong, good only for the dogs. High meat. In some of the literature about historical means of preserving meat and fish, flesh that has begun to putrefy is referred to as high meat. There is a contemporary nutritional ideology, known as the primal diet, that advocates the consumption of high meat for health benefits. The diet's originator and promoter, a man named Agenis van der Plaats, says that he came to believe in the healing power of high meat after a dramatic healing experience in Alaska, eating meat that had been buried, as described above. The way van der Plaats translates the process of making high meat for people in non-Arctic climates, he himself lives in Southern California, is to age cubed meat in sealed jars in the refrigerator, airing them out periodically. A woman I've corresponded with who does this, Beverly Peterson of Evanston, Illinois, described the process for me. Just cut into bite-sized pieces enough meat to loosely fill a 1-quart wide-mouth jar halfway. Put a lid on it and put it in the fridge. Every few days, take it out, open the jar, and give it fresh air by swinging it around. I suggest doing this outside so it doesn't stink up your house. Put the lid back on and put it back in the fridge. Do this for a month, and it is ready. It will keep a long time in the fridge. I have encountered a number of people through the years who swear by this practice. When they have offered me high meat, however, I have not tasted it because it always smells repulsive to me. One woman I met held her nose to eat it and cut it into tiny pieces so she could swallow it without having to chew it. While I do not advocate this practice, and I have questions about its safety, the people I've met who eat high meat all seem to be perfectly healthy, and some of them attribute great improvements in their health to it. Despite my personal reservations, in the interest of covering the topic of meat fermentation thoroughly, I am including it here. Meat and fish ethics. I cannot write a chapter about fermenting meat and fish without emphasizing that these practices evolved as strategies, each of which makes sense within its particular context. One critical aspect of this is what meat or fish may be available in abundance in a particular place at a particular time of the year. In our consumer paradise, however, most of us are woefully out of touch with this. The details of where our food comes from and the systems that get them to us, particularly meat and fish, are usually gruesome. There are small farmers in many places trying to raise animals with healthy, sustainable, and compassionate practices. I buy meat directly from people like this, and I urge you to, too. But sustainable and compassionate practices require substantial land per animal. This not only makes meat more expensive, it also limits the amount of it there can be. If we want animals for meat to be raised in healthy and humane ways, we all have to eat less of it. I love to eat meat, and I have access to local meat from farmers I admire, and I can afford to buy it, yet I find myself reluctant to glorify meat. I believe part of what can make meat eating sustainable is eating just a little of it. With fish, I do not have access to anything fresh and have not, yet, taken up fishing myself. The experimentation I have done has been with frozen fish, although I don't especially want to support the global trade of frozen fish. In a coastal place with fresh fish in daily, I would be much more inclined to buy fish. Yet the drive to scale up fishing to serve global markets has led to widespread overfishing and population declines. And let's not forget how toxic water is becoming, and how fish can concentrate heavy metals and other toxins. As with meat, part of what can make fish eating sustainable is eating just a little of it. But again, context is everything. If you do find yourself with an abundance of any resource, try to make use of it. This is how these traditions of fermenting meat and fish evolved, and how they can best be adapted to have continued relevance.